Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming out tonight, and thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and other independent bookstores around the country. We really appreciated it. I just said to Anne as I sat her down, I said, I'm doing my intro. And then I went, oh, my notes are back on the cart with the books. And she goes, just wing it. So as you know, her new book is called Small Victories. It's a beautiful book, essays about how many times, well, when I read it, it reminds me of times I've been discouraged and down and out, but somehow eventually find my way back. Or about how far we've come since we were teenagers, or since we were in our 30s, or since our divorce, or, you know, so many things throughout a lifetime that knock us down. And this book is about those special moments of grace that remind us and help us to get back up again. As you know, she's written many other books. We have them all back there. Hard Laughter. I believe you wrote that when your dad had brain cancer. That was her first novel, and she wrote it to make him laugh. There's, of course, Bird by Bird, that everybody remembers what her father said to her brother about, you've got to write that report, it's due tomorrow, and the son is worried and stressed, and the father said, son, you just have to go bird by bird. And I think that's, you know, the whole book is good advice for writers in getting through life. I also want to tell you that I'm not going to list the books because I don't have them. I don't want to rely on my brain. But I do want to tell you that years ago in the 70s or 80s, when operating instructions came out, I was sitting on my bed. I had two young boys then. And I read that book, and I just remember where I was sitting. I remember the feeling. I remember crying. I remember like, oh God, she really understands, like a first child, and how overwhelmed you are, and yet how wonderful it is, and what a miracle. But there's days where you just think you don't know what in the world you're doing, and you really do get kind of scared. And that book was so helpful. And then years later, decades later, she and her son wrote a book called Some Assembly Required. And this is about her son's first child, Anne's grandchild. And that happened to be written the year I had my first grandchild. So again, I read the book, hungry for the knowledge and the humor of your son and you. And that's a wonderful book, too. And I'm sure all of us who have read fiction of Anne's or nonfiction essays or memoir, you remember them. You don't forget. You know, you take them with you, and they're a part of your life. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Anne Lamott.
Thank you. So thank you all for coming. Thank you so many men for coming. I hope you weren't dragged here against your wishes. I'm so glad to be here. We'll have, I think I'll just talk about this book for a while because I've been on the road, and I want to leave a bunch of time for question and answers. I think that's why people really love readings, is because you get to ask the questions you actually care about. So let me think for a second. Where should I start? My first book came out 35 years ago. I was 60 this year. Isn't that amazing? And I was 26. Yeah, so I think that's 34 years, isn't it? Young people. And over the years, my first book was called Hard Laughter, and it was about a family going through, a novelized version of our family going through my father's brain cancer, and his cancer was actually a lot worse than it was in the book, but I wrote a lot about a family in grief and chaos, I was 23 when he got sick, and my younger brother was 18. And obviously, you don't have an owner's manual, you know, for the end of the world. And so I wrote a novel about it. And over the years, everything I wrote, a lot of it had to do with grieving, or with my best friend, some of you know, died almost 20 years ago now. Sam was 3 and he's 25. So that was the end of the world. This is someone I had been best friends with all through high school. I'm sorry, I'm hoarse. I've been sick for like 8 days, but I feel much better. But my voice is funny. And over the years, just you get older and people die and relatives that you just adore. And it's the culture is very clear that you need to get over this as quickly as possible, because people are very uncomfortable in the presence of real emotion and grief and total animal confusion, which you sometimes feel after a death. And my position was always that there's certain deaths you're never going to get over. you just aren't. And you're not supposed to. And it's okay. Whereas the culture says that a best friend, 3 to 6 months, approximately. A brother or sister, 6 months. Mother, father, if they're elderly, maybe a year, but not good. Better 9 months to kind of wrap it up. And then a husband or a wife, 18 months. And that's the system. And it's so confusing when the grief doesn't leave you, and when your heart just feels like the heart of a different person than the heart of the person who lost this beloved man or woman. And so I was always a staunch supporter of the process and of refusing to pretend to be doing any better than you were for as long as it took. If someone died when you were 6, your grandfather died and the lights went out for you, and it took you 20 years, thank you. I think God loves real. I just think real is the most precious thing. And I also believe that tears, instead of being unseemly, and I was really shamed into not crying a lot, and I was extremely sensitive, and everything hurt my feelings, and I understood that the world was a pretty terrible place for most people in it, you know, 90% of the world. And I understood at the pound that no one was coming later to get the leftover pets to take home. I just got it, so I cried, and I was really shamed a lot. So I just wanted to tell people, refuse to stop crying. Refuse to stop feeling what you're really feeling. So I wanted to compile all these pieces. I started about 5 years ago. I'd finished my last novel, which was called Imperfect Birds, which was the end of the Rosie trilogy. And then I started compiling some new and old pieces. Oh, I'm so sorry. I hate when people are sick, or like when anchor people have head colds. Like when news anchors have head colds. It actually makes me sick. I feel, stay home. Like, you don't need to infect the entire studio, and we'll still remember who you are, Wolf. So, but I don't think I'm contagious. So I started this book called As in Life, because my pastor, Veronica, always says, in life and in death, we're God's. And so she was in a plane when she thought was going down with her daughter, and she just said to herself, you know, in death I'm God's too. It'll be like a major change of address, but I'll still be God's precious daughter. So I like the title As in Life. So I started writing it, and I got a few pieces written. I've selected some pieces from over the years, from Traveling Mercies and Plan B and the Bush years, a left-wing Christian during the Bush years. And then, of course, you all know what it's like when you start something big. The phone rings. About a month into it, the phone rang, and it was my son Sam, who was 19, and he said, "I'm going to be a father." And it was the day before Thanksgiving. And I had like 25 people coming. And I have this funky house. It's like 20 people. And they're all just cousins and riffraff. But it kind of stopped me in my shoes, I'll tell you that. And no one cared my opinion. He was in art school. And no one asked what I thought. So he and his girlfriend had a baby who's in kindergarten now. But when this happened, when Sam and Amy were pregnant, my publisher at Riverhead asked if I would want to write a book with Sam that was a sequel to, what was it called, Operating Instructions. And I said, I think it would be exploitive. And he said, not if you didn't exploit anyone. And that had literally not occurred to me. So I asked Sam if he wanted to do it with me, and he said he would, because I didn't want to do it alone. I was working on this other book. It actually ends up being my favorite of all 15 books. It's the book I would take with me to a desert island to remember anything I might have once known spiritually. But it was a lot about letting go of the control with a grown kid. You know, this belief that you're in charge of anything, you know, that anything you have the right to remain silent. As a parent, and anything you say will be used against you. And you can't run beside your children when they're grown up, you know, with juice boxes and sunscreen, and because it's abusive too. It's so disrespectful. It's crazy to try to commandeer someone else's hero's journey, you know? And so I wrote a lot about letting go, letting go, letting go. Oh, and the torture, how hard it was, how hard. And there was this acronym I heard, WAIT for wait. And it was for why am I talking? And I just lived by that. And Sam and I wrote this book. It took about a year. It took a year because it was a journal of my son's first son. And then we went out on book tour together. And while we were out in New York, my publisher was at my reading, of course. And he's completely non-spiritual. And somebody in the audience said, how did your spiritual life change after your son had a child? And I said, well, you know, I got sober in 86. You know, I've been sober a long time, and I realized then that the only prayers anyone ever needed, especially an alcoholic, were help and thanks. Is help me, help me, help me. A new alcoholic. And then I finally realized, like, wow, was such a great prayer, because it's sort of like it's like the universe is spritzing you with a plant mister, you know, when you step outside. Like, I don't know if it's overcast tonight, but if you step out and look up at the sun, you don't go, or at the stars tonight, you don't go, well, it's a medium starry night here in Colorado. Oh, the mountains are kind of medium today. The snowy peaks. I mean, nice. You don't do that. You look at them, and every single time you go, wow. Right? So I thought, that's a third great prayer. Now I have a fourth great prayer, because I have this hilarious belief that things are going to turn out the way I want. And so I think the fourth great prayer is, whatever. Or as the young people say, whatever. So I was talking about help, thanks, wow. It's all I need to remember. I just need to remember to pray. I say hi to God. I say, hi, I hate this, and I hate everyone. And I think God says, thank you. Good. I'm right here. You get to be who you are. You get to be real. You get to tell the truth. You get to say what's true for you. So after I was done, my publisher came up to me and he said, I would like a cup of that, of help, thanks, wow, which was such a sweet way to say it. And he asked if I would write a prayer book, the three essential prayers. And so I said, sure. And it meant putting aside as in life again, but I was getting kind of used to it. And I wrote Help, Thanks, Wow. That took about a year, not quite. And then went out on book tour, and you're just wasted afterwards. You're mentally ill and used up completely after 3 weeks, and you know, in like 18 different cities, you're just, it's like the worst jet lag. And so that took me through the next year. So I started, as in life, up again. And then the end of the world, the shootings at Sandy Hook, right? On a Friday, the shootings at Newtown, and they stopped me in a way that even 9/11 didn't stop me. They stopped me literally cold. And after a little while, I started thinking about my Sunday school kids and what I could possibly tell them on Sunday, because I always tell them you're safe, you're loved, you're chosen exactly the way you are, you're perfectly and fearfully, vulnerably made, and you're precious, and you're safe. And if you ever feel scared, come find one of us. And then I thought, how am I going to tell them they're safe after Sandy Hook? And then I started trying to figure out where you could even start. Well, I thought of something the great Barry Lopez said, the novelist. He said, sometimes people need a story more than they need food. And he also said, when all is said and done, all we have is compassion and stories. And so I thought, well, I'll tell the kids some stories, because the kids love stories. They love Bible stories where something like bad happens. I mean, they're not stupid, you know? Chariots, death, the sun going black, they're in. So I thought, well, I'll tell them some stories. And then I actually thought of a story that my pastor told. And I had a place to start. And for those of you that are writers, you know all you need to do is to find out from within, in your heart, one place you could start, one episode you could describe, one passage you could write, one memory you absolutely know is somehow emotionally and in a cellular way central to the bigger project you're undertaking. So I'm just going to read you like 4 pages from Stitches. Okay, because I remembered this story. My pastor Veronica one Sunday told a story of a sparrow lying in the street with its legs straight up in the air, sweating a little under its feathery arms. A warhorse walks up to the bird and asks, "What on earth are you doing?" The sparrow replies, "I heard the sky was falling and I wanted to help." The horse laughs a big, loud, sneering horse laugh and says, "Do you really think you're going to hold back the sky with those scrawny little legs?" And the bird says, "One does what one can." So what could I do? Not much. Mother Teresa said that none of us can do great things, but we can do small things with great love. This has saved me many times. So I showed up to teach Sunday school 2 days after the Newtown shootings. I didn't overthink what I would say, because I always end up telling the kids the same things. They are loved, they are chosen, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And to keep trusting God no matter what things look like and no matter how long an upswing takes. If something awful has occurred, I ask the kids at Sunday school if they want to talk about what has happened or if they would rather make art. 100% of the time, they would rather make art. We begin by lighting a candle. Then we pray to try to be good and kind to one another. We read a short passage of scripture, talk about it, and try to learn something together about our lives and God's love. And then, as in all great religious traditions, we overeat. That Sunday after Newtown, I decided we would make angels out of coffee filters. Years ago, I located a great website on crafts you can make from coffee filters. We're a church with literally zero money. Like, I know some of you go to very small churches, and it's beyond shoestring. It's like, you know what it's like. So we don't have an art budget, you know. We've made garlands of coffee-filtered doves for Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And for Easter, we make bright coffee-filter butterflies and chrysalises of paper towel rolls into which we tuck the butterflies until Easter morning. Nothing looks more dead than a cocoon, particularly when it's made out of a cardboard tube from an empty roll of Bounty. I intended to bring my stapler from home to make it easier to put the angels together, but I conveniently left it on the kitchen table. But at least we had our coffee filters. There were only two students there that day, both young teenagers who were differently abled. The boy has been living for years with brain cancer, which led to a bleed that has left him with a brain injury. So he talks sort of funny. The other student is a gorgeous girl who was the person... Oh, I skipped this part so it won't make sense because it's boring. I can save us a little time here. I read them a subversive verse from Luke. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. I read that again. It's so beautiful. And it came to pass that the beggar died and was carried by the angels into Abraham's bosom. Right? In the most ultimately patriarchal society, the poorest of the poor and the dead poorest of the poor, seen by the people to be a human worthy of carrying into the very heart of the parent, of the father. So I told them that angels are always around, messengers of God's love, to revive us when we're weary or in an ugly place, and to help us cross over when we die. Then I opened a nice fresh package of round white coffee filters. Oh no, the girl said, bending over in her chair so that she smashed her forehead on the table. I asked if she was hurt. There was no motion or sound. Then she bleated out, "Not coffee filters again." Mason, on the other hand, beamed. I sighed and somehow, with my charm and legendary patience, got the girl up and running again. We colored our coffee filters with markers. While we worked, I talked in a general way about how what good people can do in the face of great sorrow. We help some time pass for those suffering. We sit with them in their hopeless pain, and we feel terrible with them without trying to fix them with platitudes. Doing this with them is just about the most gracious gift we have to offer. We help them to bear being in time and space. During unbearable times and spaces, I would add that in general, time and space have not been my strong suits. I'd like to be able to explain the world to these loved, lovely, and challenged children that would help them understand the meaning of life and make sense of their differences. But there can be meaning without having things make sense. Humanity is meaning. It is a synonym for the best of being human, thoughtful, sensitive, caring, and compassionate. I asked them if they knew what humane meant. The girl raised her hand. It meant, why are all of our projects about coffee filters? What a paradox that we connect with God, with divinity in our strangeness in our flesh and our blood and time and space. We connect with God and our humanity. A great truth attributed to Emily Dickinson is that hope inspires the good to reveal itself. This is almost all I ever need to remember. Gravity and sadness yank us down, and hope gives us a nudge to help one another get back up or to sit with the fallen on the ground in the abyss in solidarity. After we colored our coffee filter wings, we spritzed them with water so that the dyes ran slightly. While the filters dried, we had our snacks, string cheese, pears, and Capri Sun, the living water of most Sunday schools. We made our angels' heads with a second filter each, scrunched up around balled-up Kleenex, secured with embroidery thread. This gave the angels an unfortunate, garroted look. But the heads held, which is all that ever matters. The remaining paper that spread out beneath was the bodies. At this point, it would have been fabulous if a certain special someone had remembered to bring the stapler from home, because we had to attach the angels to their fabulous tie-dyed and now fairly dry wings. Instead, I got out my tiny travel sewing kit and stitch the wings to the bodies like the love children of Betsy Ross and Wavy Gravy. And then I fluffed out the brightly colored filters for maximum angelic wingspan. The children loved them, and I knew the parents would too. The angels were just completely fabulous. Then Mason made an astonishing comment. He said to the girl adamantly in his slightly garbled and mumbly way, "You know, I used to have brain cancer. I was in a coma, and then I was here again. Here, where our feet are. The miracle. Where we were there, and oh, we're here again." I had to close my eyes at the beauty of his understanding that he was here again. He had woken up as we are all called to do. I said, "Mason, you are a miracle." The girl asked me in her own slightly garbled way, "Why does he talk so funny?" Mason didn't seem to notice. He said, "Yes, I am a miracle." Then he raised his arms and fists like muscle man. So that was 2 days after Newtown, Sandy Hook, And I thought something I've thought so many times and taught, actually, when I used to teach writing, I always told my students, write what you'd love to come upon. If you love to come upon a historical novel, a memoir, confessional novels or letters, I used to love letters. There are like 10 volumes of Virginia Woolf's letters, and I've read every one of them, and her journals. And if you love to read poetry, it's like very good information that we don't usually have access to. So I thought I would love for someone to have a book on meaning in the face of really annihilating awfulness. And so I wrote one. And then took about a year, went out on book tour, came home, and I finally got to write this book. But because I'd written it Stitches and to some extent Help, Thanks, Wow, It was kind of, I'd written so much about grief already, sort of a handbook on grief and coming through and helping other people through it, that I couldn't really do it anymore. So I started this book that turned out to be Small Victories, Spotting Improbable Moments of Grace. Like, I would argue that that story I just read you, Mason and that wild girl, Bree, that was grace. That's what grace looks like. Grace looks like people getting through the day together, feeding each other, making art. So I was going to just read you a little bit from this book, but I can talk to you about it and just do a five-minute reading. So I have this great friend. I had a great friend named Barbara Brenner in the city who passed about a year ago. And she had founded this organization, some of you have heard of, about 15 years ago in San Francisco, but that's national, called Breast Cancer Action. And they are the radical activists of breast cancer. They're the bad girls of breast cancer. And I could tell you on this one hand, five people I have known who are alive because they're doing the research, and they were doing the path less chosen in a very profound and holistic way. And they were doing the research that was teaching women that just because somebody was supporting breast cancer research, you still might have to be careful about the cosmetics they were selling or the cleaning products where they'd made their fortune because they were carcinogenic. So they weren't the adorable breast cancer group, but Barbara had it twice, both times very bad. Metastases, and she was fine, you know, and I did a lot of benefits from over the year. Well, she got the one disease that you're really supposed to try not to get, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. And she did everything. She did an amazing job with it, but she had about 2 years of very, very rich life living. You know, 2 years were after she'd been with her wife for 30 years, you know, 27 of those years when the Giants had lost, you know. And for two of the three last years she was here, the Giants had won the pennant. Maybe some of you don't remember that, not being from San Francisco. But I grew up on the Giants, and it was about just tears and pain and love. Willie Mays and McCovey and Cepeda, and oh my God, I loved them so much. And so I stayed really close to them. I wanted to help Barbara's papers get published, and I just loved them both so much. And so we went for a hike, a walk at Muir Woods, which some of you have been to, which is like a great cathedral. I know you have places like that here that are like European sacred mountains of it's like the reverberation, you know, after an echo, or when you've been running your finger around a glass. And we went there, and the whole morning I had been thinking how sad it was that she wasn't going to be around much longer, and that Susie wouldn't have her, we all that loved her wouldn't have her, Breast Cancer Action wasn't going to have her. She'd been executive director for 15 years. And then I had an epiphany. And I've always told my writing students, don't wait. You don't wait for epiphanies. You don't wait for inspiration. That's just another way to get out of doing your work. You know, you sit down and you hold a pop gun to your head. And we're really into pop guns at my house because we're reading Winnie the Pooh. So we, you know, so you hold a pop gun to your head and you keep your butt in the chair. It's the only way. But I had a very rare moment of inspiration looking at Barbara and Susie. I realized that it was a victory lap. These two women had been there for 30 years together with the deepest love and enjoyment, and had founded this amazing organization. Susie actually worked at a job in the downtown San Francisco, but she had been a part of Breast Cancer Action. We had done all the fundraisers, all these calls to action against the chemical companies supporting breast cancer walks that were making cosmetics that could give you cancer, that were selling chemotherapeutic drugs that could cause cancer. Crazy. And I love a march, you know. I am going to be marching this side of the grave. And I realized how beautiful, how stunning, how sacred this day was, this morning was, this 2 hours was at Muir Woods. And I got this idea for small victories, that it's not where they, in my infinite paranoia, the grown-ups or the parents or the culture or the college tells you the salvation will be, the filling up, the finding out who you are, the joyfully expressing the spirit that you are. It's going to be in these small moments of kindness that just surprise you, where you just kind of pinch yourself. It could be a look from somebody. It could be, for me, a lot of this book is about forgiveness, because I just have such a hard time with forgiveness. I'm just like one of those Christians who's not heavily into forgiveness. And another thing I don't go for is letting go. So those are like the two things that everybody on a spiritual path is supposed to cultivate. Forgiveness and letting go. And they're just hard work. I mean, if people say to me, let go and let God, I just want to stab them, you know? I just feel like, how dare you? Like, if I could let go, that's what I'd be doing. And, you know, grace and healing and restoration are not going to come to us through bumper stickers. They're not. For me, they've come through the friendships I've had with women and a couple men, my brothers, my son, my grandchild, my church, my sober community. It comes in a small face. It comes when someone just touches you a certain way. It comes when somebody you're really mad at or have been holding a grudge at or who has been grudgy towards you just touches your sweater for a second, and you go, oh, my God. So that's how this book came to be. And then all the pieces were structured or chosen because some of them are like my favorite pieces from 20 years ago from Traveling Mercies. But if you're a writer, like with most other forms of art, you could have a retrospective show. If you're a folk singer, everybody wants to hear your old songs, you know. And with a writer, it's like, okay, let's get on with the next one. You know, people are saying to me, what are you going to do next? I'm on book tour. You know, I'm sick. I'm on book tour. I don't know. So, I was going to read you I'll read you the first couple of pages that are about Barbara and Susie. Prelude, Victory Lap. The worst possible thing you can do when you're down in the dumps, tweaking, vaporous with victimized self-righteousness or bored, is to take a walk with dying friends. They will ruin everything for you. First of all, friends like this may not even think of themselves as dying, although they clearly are, according to recent scans and gentle doctor's reports. No, they see themselves as fully alive. I have to make a note to myself to ask something in a minute. They're living and doing as much as they can, as well as they can, for as long as they can. They ruin your multitasking high, the bath of agitation, rumination, and judgment you wallow in, without the decency to come out and just say anything. They bust you for being grateful for the day, while you are obsessed with how thin your lashes have become and how wide your bottom. My friend Barbara had already been living with Lou Gehrig's disease for 2 years on the spring morning of our Muir Woods hike. She had done and tried everything, and you would think, but she'd done everything to stem the tide of deterioration. And you would think, upon seeing her with a fancy four-wheeled walker needing an iPad-based computer voice named Kate to speak for her, that her, do you know how that works? Somebody types on an iPad and the voice says it out loud. That the disease was having its way. And this would be true, except that beside having ALS, Barbara had her breathtaking mind, a joyously bottomless thirst for nature, and Susie. Susie, her girlfriend of 30 years, gave her an unfair advantage over the rest of us. We could all be great if we had Susie. We could be heroes. Barbara was the executive director, so I've told you all about that. Barbara and Susie were like your smartest cousins with the beauty of friendly, intelligent engagement and good nature. Barbara's face was set now, almost as a mask, like something the wind is blowing hard against, and she'd lost a lot of weight so you could see the shape of her animal and bones and branches and humanity. Yet she still had a smile that got you every time, not a flash of high-wattage white teeth, but the beauty of low-watt, the light that comes in through the bottom branches, sweet, peaceful, and wry. We set off. She was our lead duck, our cycling leader, the only person on wheels sussing up what lay before us on the trailhead. Susie walked ever so slightly behind, and I walked behind in the slipstream. Even on the path that leads through these woods, you feel the wildness. The trees are so huge that they shut you up. They are like mythical horse flanks and elephant skins, exuding such life and energy that their stillness makes you suspect they're playing red light, green light with you. The last time we'd had lunch, Barbara was still speaking. She talked a lot about her wellness blog, although her voice wasn't very good, and her need for supplemental nutrition. Breath, nutrition, voice, that's all we need. Breath, nutrition, voice. She posted a list on her blog from time to time of all the things she could still do. Most recently, enjoy the hummingbirds, sleep with my sweetie, and speak out for people with breast cancer. Now she is silent. When she wants to talk, she can type words on her iPad that Kate will then speak with efficient warmth, or she can rest in the silence. I'm a fast walker because my dad had long legs and I learned to keep up. But today a walk with Barbara was like, Mother, may I take 1,000 slow baby steps? Barbara looked, seemed by the look on her look of concentration, to align herself with all the particles here in the looming woods, so she could be as present and equal as possible. She couldn't bother with saying anything unimportant because she had to type it first. This relieved us all from making crazy chatter. This is a musical grove. The redwoods are like organ pipes playing silent chords. Susie pointed out birds she knew and moved a few obstacles on our route as Barbara rolled on. Susie is the ultimate support, a weight-bearing wall, holding the two of them together to be comfortable in the duo of them. She has lots of sly humor but no gossipy edge, except in a pinch. I love Wendell Berry's lines that it may be that we know when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work, and that when we no longer know which way to go, we have begun our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. Isn't that a great line? The impeded stream is the one that sings. That's an amazing line. I have a lot of faith and a lot of fear a lot of the time. The ferns looked almost as if they had sprung from an umbrella shaft. You could click it and cock it, and the spokes would burst forth or could be put away. We picked up speed and barreled around the next corner, going 1 mile an hour. Susie mentioned that they had to go back to San Francisco for a meeting. The city seemed very far away. We passed a great show of burl in a thick, lumpy flow, as if it had been arrested in downward movement, like mud or lava. One burl looked exactly like a bear cub. Ferns and sometimes whole redwoods spring from burl. The ferns remind you of prehistory. Dinosaurs hide behind them. They are elegant, tough, and exuberant, like feathers in a woman's cap. I asked Barbara, "Are you afraid very often?" She shrugged, smiled, stopped to type on her laptop, and hit send. Kate spoke. "Not today." So that, to me, is what grace looks like. Not today. And anyway, I'd love to take some questions, if any of you have them, about writing or grandmotherhood or the Kardashian butt. Yes. How Pammy's family is, well, the only person I'm still close to, I love her sister-in-laws. One of her sister-in-laws was Elizabeth Murray, who's done these very painterly photography books. I hate to say this at an independent bookstore, but the easiest way to find them would go to Amazon and write in Elizabeth Murray, and there'll be some Elizabeth Murrays that aren't doing painterly photography. They're mind-blowing, very mystical. And her daughter's great, Rebecca, is 23, really tall, really good pianist, very cultish, and just darling. She calls, "Is this my adorable godmother?" So she's beautiful. Yes, sir.
How do you foster resilience?
How do I foster resilience? I would say it's taken me the last three books to talk about that, because it's hard and it's a huge, how do you foster resilience? So I can give you a very short and inadequate answer. I do all the things that make me alive and awake. I stop hitting the snooze button. I get myself up. I get myself outside. I get to church. I find sober people. I read the very, very best books I can. I read great spiritual masters from all over the ages. I read more poetry. I have impeccable friends. The reason I have such devout faith in God is because of the quality of my friends. And from my friends came the resilience, because I know some of the most awful things that could ever happen to a person have happened to me and my family. And we didn't ever leave anyone alone. And we came through. In September, my brother's wife died. My older brother's wife died. She was 60. My dog, Lily, who was 13, who was a perfect person, Jesus in a dog suit, died. I dropped a 60-pound box of tiles on my foot, split the toe open, and broke my toe and needed a lot of stitches. And one of the people I'm closest to needed to be institutionalized. And that was 1 month. And you know what? The grace was sufficient. The grace of people not trying to fix each other, of just saying, "What do you need? Do you need food, or do you need us to come take some of the food that other people have been bringing? We can help you with that." I never stopped going to church. I never stopped hiking, even with my post-op boot on. I went to Japan 3 weeks ago with a post-op boot. You know, I never stopped walking, and I never stopped trusting that I'm loved and I'm chosen and I'm safe no matter what things look like. And that more will be revealed, and that the grace bats last, you know? And so that's the short answer, although it was a little long. Yes? Can I talk about being very present in the moment, which I am about 50% of the time, like the rest of you? You know, I'm sort of as horribly human as you can get with all the other stuff too. You know, the tripping out and the tweaking, and you know, I can be left to my own devices. I can be very judgmental instantly, but I'm not left to my own devices very often. That's what saves me. And I just practice. I make myself meditate. We get out the pop gun, you know, and I do a lot of walking sorts of meditation. I read a lot of books about being present. Poetry makes you very, very present. And you know what? It's so, you're young. You look young from back here. But getting older, the grace of it is that I used to care about so much stuff that I could really care less about now. And I didn't get myself to not care. It was that I got older, that people died, that I saw people, the very best people, go through challenges where you had to wonder if there could really be a merciful God and a love energy surrounding and indwelling. And you stick together. And so when one of you who is 60 or 70 or 80 loses that faith that this is going to be okay, the other one remembers. This is why people are able to stay sober, because we're not all well on the same day, so that you call around until you find somebody who is kind of semi sort of liking their life and having faith and definitely not drinking and all that. And when you get older, like, I used to care so much more about my butt, you know? I really did. I mean, I do a little now, but I've been for 10 years. It was like, you know, we don't fix ourselves, and we don't fix our obsessive petty minds with our obsessive petty minds. But by 50, I'd lost a number of people, and I thought, by God, any chance of swimming is going to be a time where I'm going to be getting in the water in front of strangers, in front of men I'm going out with. If you've read Traveling Mercies, you know I have flabby thighs. I have tried everything. They're not going to change, but I changed. My heart changed. My mind changed. I practice radical self-care, and that helps me be present. How are you doing? I'm hungry. And the voice inside me would say, well, that's not really very convenient right now. That you're hungry. Could you not be? No, I don't do that anymore. I get food. I called someone on the way up here and I said, I was at the hotel for 7 minutes from the airport before I turned around. And I said, you need to have some food. And they found wonderful, delicious food. And I do this total militant self-care. I do not have scary people in my life. When you get older, at some point you go, why do I keep having lunch with that person? I'm kind of sick to my stomach all morning. And then when I've seen him or her, I check it off a list where I don't have to do it for you. How long am I going to live? Not long enough. I had a therapist a few years ago, 10 years ago, who said the most brilliant thing. She said, it's so wonderful to always be honest, but if you have to take care of yourself by telling a little lie, tell a little lie. So, you know, I'm unavailable. My grandson and son live with me 50% of the time. 50% of the time. So I'm tired all the time. I'm tired all the time, and I am in kind of domestic goddess mode a lot. I drive a 5-year-old to school. I pick him up. I do this. And I am just radically on my own side. Are you okay? Do you need help? Who can we call? What can we buy? And I talk to myself that way. And that came in my late 40s, because you just realize you spend your life force taking care of everyone, especially all the men and boys, and you just give up your life and your time and all that is precious so that everybody else can feel great. And finally, you just go, wow, you know, my back hurts. And what I want to do is lie on the couch and read the New Yorker. And I want to just, the only person I want to be with is my dog. I don't feel like being friendly, you know, so My 5-year-old, I'll tell you two quick stories. My grandson said the two funniest things. I probably tweeted them, which is one thing I want to ask. He said to me the other morning, really early, he said, "Nana, what if you die?" He said, "I hardly know anything." And I said, "I don't either." And then I said, "But what do you want to learn?" He said, "How to make coffee." And sometimes I'll say, "Honey, could you," because he gets up really early. He comes and gets in my bed because it's warm and the dog is there. And I'll say, "Hey, could you run in the kitchen and make me coffee?" He'll go, "Nana, I'm just a little boy." And so, but he said he wanted to learn to make coffee. He wanted to learn how to drive. And he wanted to learn how to use the shower faucets, which are funky. It's an old, funky house. So, and then the other thing he said that I just loved about a month ago, he said, "Can I take a shower with you if I promise not to laugh?" So the question I wanted to ask you, because I'm very new to Twitter and Facebook. I only began Twitter and Facebook when Sam and I published some assembly, because he made me. He said, "I won't go out with you. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. This is what's happening. This is what you do." There are no review sites left. There are very, very, very few book reviews. He said, you do it. And my publisher that said the same thing. So I started tweeting. I remember when I had 100 followers on Twitter, and I called Sam up and said, "Sam, I have 100 followers. Whoa, Mom, way to go." You know, and now it's kind of my life. But but I don't follow anybody, so I'm not on Facebook very often unless I have something that's really on my heart. Or right now, they're doing all this promotion. I have to tell people where I'm going to be. But so I wanted to ask you, how many people came because they saw this on something I tweeted or wrote about? See, a lot of you. Wow. It's such a funny world. I mean, in about a year, my grandson will be able to surpass me on the computer. I can do almost nothing. Almost nothing. Maybe one or two more questions? Yes, in the aqua, and then you in the black over here. Yeah. Hi.
Mm-hmm. And I lost my 18-year-old daughter 10 months ago.
Oh.
And I decided I was either going to check myself into a psych hospital or write a book.
Right.
So you'll be relieved to know that I'm trying to write a book. But I was just wondering, do you have any tips or advice about how to sit down and write what goes in that little one-inch?
You know, everything I know about writing anything applies to what I know about writing everything. And all I can say is it is going to be an incredible gift to yourself and to your daughter and to all the other mothers and fathers who lose children, because we're losing children now. Marin, where I live, which is a very wealthy enclave, 4 of Sam's friends have died from high school. I have a bumper sticker on my Volkswagen that says, "I love Casey," and it's a girl that died a couple years ago, and her father wrote a book. It's fantastic. And I won't be able to think of what it's called, but she had been adopted from if not Russia, then Ukraine, and had come over with just as an infant, as a 6-month-old, you know, fished out of one of those shitty cribs with no nutrition, and had a whole different set of problems, and grew up in this wealthy enclave where all the kids are taking a ton of drugs. So, and it's a beautiful book, and it brought life. And all around Marin, I'll see people with these little bumper stickers that say, "I love Casey." And I'll see the parents at the dog park. And it healed them, you know. It healed them, and they'll never get over it. You know, they'll be sad their entire time here. But my friend, the friend of this boy I read you about with the brain cancer, she's writing a novel. She's a fantastic writer. And she's writing stories about he had a bleed about 4 years ago. He has an inoperable kind of cancer called an astrocytoma. And he's okay, but you know, it's pretty precarious. It's on his brain. It's right above his brainstem. And she wrote about like Barbara saying, I'm okay today. I'm not afraid today. She wrote about the stuff the doctors did. She talked about the stuff that was beautiful and outrageously awful that other people said, you know, and what kept her going and what happened when she, when nothing did. And, but everything I know about writing is in Bird by Bird. You get the pop gun. You keep your butt in the chair. I have the equal proportions of grandiosity and zero self-esteem. I sit down at the same time 5 days a week. And I don't do it because I want to. I never want to. I do it as a debt of honor. And you have such a beautiful living debt of honor, you know, and I just hope that you do it. It will change the whole world. Yeah, it'll change the whole world. And one more question over here. Yeah. When you don't have a burning topic or theme, but you want to write, you've written a lot. Yeah, yeah, I understand. The thing is, I don't really ever have burning ideas. I just really don't. Like, to understand this thing about victory laps was very rare for me. Like for the radio dial to get tuned in so precisely. And what I do in lieu of that is I just sit down. Oh, I know one thing I do is I make, I scribble down, and you, the mother who just asked the question, I would recommend this too. I scribble down on legal paper things I want to get to, because things will start floating in like goldfish, you know, and then that voice inside you from being five will say, if it's important, you'll remember it. And, you know, I didn't remember at five. I was just exactly like this at five. I was a space case. And menopause 10 years ago did not heighten my acuity. And I scribbled down notes. I want to write about that time at my grandfather's church. I want to write about that time with my Uncle Don in that weird little pond out on the coast at Inverness. And I want to write about the time with the fire. You know, your memories of holidays tend to be really good. And I just do it. It's like practicing scales. If I don't know what I'm doing, I pick something from the list. And I write incredibly shitty first drafts. I write terrible first drafts. Anything I've ever written that you might like, it's three and four drafts, everything. And I don't, I do it because if you want to be a writer, you get to be. You know, the bad news is you have to write. You know, the one fly in the ointment. But if you do the writing, then you get to be a writer. And at the end of the day, every day, and probably at the end of our lives, you're going to feel like, I did it. You know, it's like being one of the kids in Willy Wonka, Charlie and Chocolate Factory, that gets one of the gold tickets. You know, and if you get to be a musician or an artist or a sculptor or a dancer here, you got one of the golden tickets. And you just do it. And it helps me so much to scribble down memories and possible ideas. You know, they're not even ideas. They're things that I might have an idea about, but I have to get it down on the list. One thing that helps me so much, because I'm very visual, two things that help me, and then I'm going to close with a fantastic poem I want you to know about. I string a piece of fishing line from one side of the room. My office is tiny, and Jax, my grandson, sleeps in it now. He's taken it over. It's now called Jax's room. But I have a tiny little corner, and it's all you need. I have a desk, and I can put a fishing line or laundry cord across it. And when I either have an idea, I will clip it up with a clothespin, or if I can scribble a passage, if I can sit in bed and write some, like one thing I do is I write letters or imagine writing a letter to my younger brother, who's my safest person. He's the one person I'm sure of. You know, like in Winnie the Pooh, where Piglet says, I just needed to be sure of you. I'm sure of my younger brother. And so I'll pretend that I'm just telling him about this experience. And then I don't have all these critical voices and reviewers and whatnot. And so I'll have all of these different kinds of notes, but they'll be up. And it's kind of like they get air and my breath adds to it. And I don't know what to do. And I don't say, well, we'll do it another day. I go and I pick something. I'm going to write about it. And the other thing that really helps me is I get really huge sheets of graph paper, which they have at Staples or anywhere at all, because from a young child, first of all, I was really good at math, which is kind of counterintuitive. You wouldn't think that. But I was really good at math, and when you have graph paper, everything is instantly more organized than it was, right? Because you have a grid. And I tape them horizontally. I'll tape one here and then one here. And I'll start with one place I know I want to cover. And I'll put sort of I'll make a circle like a lily pad as the starting place. Someone told me the other day they knew what their ending was, but it was like the middle. You can put a circle at the ending. And then in these circles with pencil, you know, the big circles, so you have some space instead of like all your life where people are trying to get you to get it right and take as few words as possible and as few space. And all women particularly should take up as little space as possible and have as few needs, none if possible. And you can be expansive and you can write in your circle anything you know about that one passage, that one period of time in Belgium, that week that you were there with your really, really amazing cousin right after you'd had the breakdown. What do you remember? I remember what the breakfast, you know, I just was actually in Belgium. They have at every breakfast buffet maybe 5 pounds of chocolate with like cheese, those cheese cutters. It's crazy. But then you remember that girl, Louise, from your college dorm, and you remember that day where you found her passed out. It's all you're going to do. But you put it, you write a note to yourself, Louise at Robinson. And it's in a big circle. There's a lot, and you sort of get yourself across the pond of your narrative to the ending. But pencils are very important. Taking stuff out is half of creation. Just like I was saying, when you become 50, late 40s, you take out about half of the BS, you know. And you go, oh, thank you for sharing. No thanks. Okay, let me read you this Billy Collins poem, because if you don't know about Billy Collins, that's another way all of the questions I've answered would somehow be answered by reading more poetry. And Billy Collins is lovely and funny, oh, and honest and human. And what he writes about is the most, and I know that they have tons of Billy Collins here. He writes about, my pastor talks about that we have dual citizenship, you know, and it's very hard that we have citizenship here in our biographies and our families, where we live, what we've come through, what we anticipate. And then we have the other citizenship of maybe a few concentric circles out, where the unseen is just as real to some of us as the seen. And Billy Collins takes the most ordinary anything, the curly birthday ribbon, you know, and he makes you see that it's part of a holy moment if you're actually there for it. There's nowhere to get to. You don't need to go to Nepal. You could be at a Safeway in Denver. You know, you could be anywhere at all and have that moment if you just were paying attention. There was a guy, a father, a priest, who helped Alcoholics Anonymous get off the ground, although he was not himself an alcoholic, and he was very, very present for Bill Wilson. And he said, sometimes I think that heaven is just a new pair of glasses. And Billy Collins is about a new pair of glasses. So this is the epigraph from Small Victories. It's called In the Evening. The heads of roses begin to droop. The bee, who has been hauling his gold all day, finds a hexagon in which to rest. In the sky, traces of clouds, the last few darting birds, watercolors on the horizon. The white cat sits facing a wall. The horse in the field is asleep on its feet. Wow. I light a candle on the wood table. I take another sip of wine. I pick an onion and a knife. And the past and the future, nothing but an only child with two different masks. So bless you and keep you and thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.